It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to speak with somebody, so many people across the state in a virtual capacity, and not have to organize everyone to the same room, et cetera. Nothing will hold us back from talking about well-being today. No hurricanes, no travel problems, no traffic. So we're all in a good space and together virtually. So my name is Shannon Seldo. I'm a professor in the School Psychology Program at the University of South Florida. And for about the past 20 years, I've had the great fortune to study how to assess and promote children's subjective well-being, which is a scientific term for happiness, if you will. And started my career at University of South Carolina, where we studied statewide kids' happiness, then moved to Baltimore City and applied it and work with inner city students, and then have been in Tampa for the last 15 years. And what I am excited to share with you today, advance to the next slide, are some updates on the work that we have been doing over the last 15 years to assess and promote children's happiness. So we'll talk about, first off, why does happiness matter? I'll share with you a description of student mental health that comes from a positive psychology lens. Also talk about the link between wellness and students' academic success. And after I hopefully have provided a rationale for wellness mattering, we'll get into what do we do about it. So I'll share with you some intervention strategies for both students that have room for growth and happiness, as well as classes of students. And I will leave you with some additional resources. So as Andrew mentioned earlier on, the file pod in the bottom left, at least on my screen, contains some additional resources. So today's talk will hopefully provide you with an overview of positive psychology, but you'll need some more self-study and practice after today, and hopefully the resources I'll share both verbally as well in the bottom left are going to help your own education and well-being promotion. I see a lot of typing in the left, and if you have questions during the talk, I do not know how to work the raised hand button that's over my skill set, but I'll try to screen to the chat box, and this is my area of passion. I prepared some work that I'll share, but I also am happy to deviate and answer any questions you have on tangential topics. So let me know if you have questions by using the chat box and we'll get started. So first thing I wanted to set the stage for is, what do we mean by this conceptualization of mental health? What does mental health mean today in schools, in society? And about 20 years ago, Rod Reiser and Jackie Eccles put forth a definition of mental health that was appropriate for schools in particular. And they said, you know, when we look at kids functioning, we could look at students and how they're doing academically or how children are doing emotionally. And students' primary setting is in a school context. So what they put forth is a definition of youth functioning. It was very holistic. You know, it was 20 years ago. It's still quite timely. And on the far left are some indicators of academic functioning. We know that the successful student is motivated to be there. They feel good about their ability to achieve. They earn good grades, good test scores, and they also show good behaviors in class and attend. So that's that bottom row of indicators. So we look at both behavioral and psychological indicators of academic success. And on the far right, the indicators of a successful child are more social emotional. So these are what we refer to as, let's say, mental health. And on the bottom row, what they proposed about 20 years ago is that mental health is defined by emotional distress, so symptoms of things like anxiety and behavior problems, but also indicators of wellness and how students are doing socially. So those behavioral and psychological indicators constitute social emotional well-being. So holistically, when we think about youth outcomes and we're looking at the context of schooling, we want to look both at how they're doing academically and emotionally. So I'm going to talk about happiness throughout the rest of our hour or so together, but I wanted to note that that's not the whole picture. And I'm going to advance for you a framework called a dual factor model of mental health. And it starts by acknowledging, recognizing there's a whole lot of students that have emotional distress. I would love to just talk about how to promote children's happiness, but that would really not do full justice to the fact that there are a good number of students that are predisposed to forms of mental illness. And mental illness is different. It's related to, but different than happiness. We'll talk about that more. So how many students do we have out there that we need to direct clinical services to? Well, we've known for quite some time that about 20% of youth at any given time would be diagnosed with a mental health disorder. And in our recent statistics that are advanced by a study that was conducted by Mira Kangas and colleagues, what they found is they went into a representative sample of 10,000 homes all throughout the country. So not just samples of kids in Baltimore or Florida, but went into all 50 states, did a representative study, and went into those homes and did clinical interviews with children and their parents, and did a full diagnostic interview to see, do you meet criteria for any mental health disorder now or at a previous time during your youth? What they found, and the prevalence rates are on the screen, is that 20% rate is probably an underestimate. This recent study of all American youth found that by the time kids hit kindergarten, age 5, about 15% would meet criteria for an anxiety disorder. By the time they get out of elementary school, so age 10, about 25% of students meet criteria for an anxiety disorder. Anxiety is that red line at the very top, and by far the most prevalent form of mental health challenge. The blue line is behavior disorders, and for those of you who serve elementary schools, no surprise there, that's the most common after anxiety form of mental health problem we see in youth. By the time kids are 10, about 10% of them will meet criteria for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or optional defiant disorder or conduct disorder. Those of you who serve middle school and adolescents and high school students, adolescent years, that's where we see those upticks in things like depression, that's the green line of mood disorders, and then in the high school years, substance use. And a lot of researchers conceptualize substance use as basically often tied to untreated mental health problems that students are trying to self-medicate and self-treat through substance use. So it's no surprise that we see those numbers uptick in the adolescent years as mental health problems are really on the rise. So there's definitely a large number of American youth who have mental health problems. And traditionally, that is where psychology has focused, is on mental illness. What hasn't been the focus traditionally is on well-being. And I'd like you to think for yourself, if you're lucky enough to have raised children that don't meet criteria for these mental health problems, does that mean that they are, by definition, happy? So is happiness simply the opposite of emotional distress? So is it possible to get through youth unscathed in terms of mental health illness, but perhaps still not be fully happy? So for a long time, folks have treated happiness like it is synonymous with the absence of mental health problems. So if you go to a psychologist and they assess you for all those different types of mental health problems that you could have, if you don't meet criteria, it's like, okay, well, you're fine, you're good to go. There's nothing for me to do for you. I can't reimburse for this care. You must be fine. But what positive psychology brought to the table was the notion that, you know, it's possible to not have mental illness, but also not be flourishing in life. And the primary outcome that folks in this area of positive psychology study is subjective well-being. That's the term on the left-hand side of your screen. And subjective well-being is a scientific term for happiness, if you will. And subjective well-being, what's kind of cool about it is it assesses the full range of experiences from really distressed and displeased and unhappy to okay or possibly languishing in life to I feel great. And that's that emotional flourishing state that we'll talk about this morning. And how subjective well-being breaks down is in two components. Somebody that is said to have high happiness has both high life satisfaction, so judges their happiness on the whole to be going well. So I'll show you some sample items, but again, on the whole, my life is going well. And then another part of happiness is the frequency with which you experience positive in relation to negative emotions. And somebody who has high happiness overall says, my life is going well, and on a daily basis, I experience more positive than negative feelings. It's okay to have negative feelings like anger and frustration, but do you have also positive experiences built into your day that are more frequent than the negative ones? So this emphasis on looking at subjective well-being in particular in tandem with mental health problems is what you'll see in a positive psychology approach to mental health care. So let's talk about that life satisfaction construct in particular. This is how we most commonly measure youth life satisfaction. It's through a 7-item self-report measure called the Student's Life Satisfaction Scale. It was developed by Scott Huebner, who is my major professor at the University of South Carolina. He developed this scale in the 90s to first see how do we assess youth life satisfaction. And kids respond on a scale of 1 to 6 to items like, my life is going well. My life is better than most kids. I have what I want in life. And there's a few reverse scored items thrown in there to make sure kids are reading. Those items are things like, I wish I had a different kind of life. And you reverse score those and get an average score. So think about the students that you've served or your own children. What age range of students would you guess has the highest average life satisfaction and maybe the lowest average? Just type it in the chat box. Grade 6, 5 to 8 might have the highest or lowest in middle school kids, okay? And then who do we think are the happiest kids, elementary, middle, or high? Highest elementary. Okay. So the folks who are saying the highest elementary, you are absolutely right. And if you were to administer this measure to lots of elementary school kids, the average score would be about a 5. Elementary school kids just start off with high life satisfaction. And I see a lot of folks typing in highest elementary. So the lowest, I'm curious if you, I see some lowest middle slash high. So what happens is when kids transition into sixth grade, so grades K through 5 typically have an average score on a scale of 1 to 6 in that 5 range. Then when they get to the middle school level, it dips down pretty reliably to about 4.5. And then it kind of stays there. So you see a dip in sixth grade that fortunately doesn't keep going low in middle school, but it's a definite dip. Then students get into high school, and on this scale of 1 to 6, a common average score then is about a 4. So they don't rebound from the middle school years. Instead, when they hit that freshman year, they tend to feel even more dissatisfied with their life. Now, a 4 is still in the mildly satisfied range. They're not hating life, but it's definitely a lower average in the middle school years. So we see this trend in life satisfaction to be pretty high in elementary school years, dip down as soon as sixth grade hits, and then in ninth grade go a little bit lower still. Still in the positive range, but a lower average. So why do we care? Like, why do we want those scores to be as high as possible? Well, what we see is that students that have higher life satisfaction earn better grades, they earn better scores on standardized tests like SCAT and the SSA. They also have more positive attitudes about learning. They're physically healthier, they have better social relationships, they tend to experience fewer instances of bullying, and if you track kids over time, they tend to develop fewer symptoms of mental health problems like depression and anxiety. So happiness tends to matter, and when we see those dips, it has implications for kids functioning in other areas too. So what I'd like to share with you is a conceptualization of mental health that integrates these two forms of mental health that seem to matter. So on the far left column are mental health problems. I established earlier that our data show a lot of kids have high mental health problems. So there's lots of students that have different forms of mental illness or symptoms, emotional distress. And in my research, how we've operationalized that is usually students that have T-scores of 60 or higher on standardized measures like the Auchenbach or the BASC. But traditionally, if a student has not met that criteria and doesn't have elevated levels of mental health problems, that students that have, it will be in this low area, then as psychologists, we typically kind of left them alone. They don't meet criteria in screening. We assume they're fine. But on the far right hand of the side, what you'll see is another factor that we're looking at, which is subjective well-being. And what my research group, my graduate students and I have looked at for the last 15 years is trying to see is are there 2 or 4 quadrants? So traditionally, we've treated students as either troubled or fine. And if they're fine, it's because we assume they have high happiness because they don't have mental health problems. So that would be this complete mental health quadrant. Whereas the troubled quadrant are the students that come up high for mental health problems, and we don't even look at their happiness. We assume they're bad off. So my students and I have looked to see if happiness is separate than mental health problems, then you'd have two other quadrants. You'd have students that are vulnerable, so they don't meet criteria for mental health problems, but when you ask them about their life satisfaction, for instance, it's relatively low. And maybe you have students that have high levels of mental health problems, but when you ask them about their life satisfaction, it's fine. Maybe they're bothering others, but not bothering themselves, or they have elevated levels of anxiety, but it works for them. Those are students that we refer to as symptomatic but content. So over the last 15 years, I've been administering measures of happiness, which is, again, technically subjective well-being, that life satisfaction affect ratios, along with measures of mental health problems to see, are these things the opposite end of the same continuum, or are they separable constructs that yield four groups? And what we have seen across samples of elementary, middle, and high school is they are absolutely separable constructs that yield four groups. At any one point in time in our cross-sectional studies, fortunately, about 58% of students have that complete mental health profile, which is, again, high happiness and low mental health problems. That's what we want for kids. Also, at any given time, across samples of elementary, middle, and high school students, what we've seen is, on average, about 12 to 15% of kids are troubled at one point in time. So they have low happiness and the presence of either teacher-rated externalizing problems or youth-rated internalizing problems. So the purple and yellow groups are the unique groups that emerge from this combination of looking at subjective well-being along with mental health problems. What we see is that yellow group are kids that would go totally overlooked if you only looked at mental health problems. So that vulnerable group are kids that don't screen high for internalizing or externalizing forms of mental illness, but are low on the life satisfaction measures. They are languishing in life. They're dissatisfied. They don't feel that many positive emotions. The purple group is interesting. These are who the kids I refer to as symptomatic but content. And about 12 to 15% of samples are kids that have elevated levels of mental health problems, but also happiness is intact. This is a series of studies that my students and I have published in School Psychology Review over a number of years that provide evidence that happiness is somewhat separable from mental health problems. And I'll share with you data next that this stuff matters. So it matters if there's differences between groups of kids that have the same level of mental health problems, but different levels of happiness. If you look at this chart and explain it thoroughly, then show some others pretty quickly. The green and yellow groups are groups that have, both of them have low levels of mental health problems. So they don't have anxiety, depression, chronic problems. So the first two groups, no mental health problems. The third and fourth groups are the groups of kids that have clinical levels of externalizing or internalizing problems. But these first two groups and the second set differ in terms of their happiness. So the green group has no mental health problems but high happiness, whereas the vulnerable students, no mental health problems but low happiness. And then the two groups with mental health problems, the purple group, has high happiness. So what do we see with GPA? This is a middle school sample. What we see is that even for kids who have no mental health problems, if you don't have high happiness, like, you're pretty much at risk for having the same level of diminished grades as the kids who have clinical levels of problems. We looked at FCAT scores when we had the FCAT in our state, and the magic number was 3, right? And what we saw was the kids who, on average, had scores higher than 3 were only the groups of kids that had the combination of no mental health problems and high happiness. Those vulnerable kids, the yellow groups, they would not have come up on our screening for mental illness because they didn't have any, and maybe asterisk yet. But they did not have clinical levels of internalizing or externalizing or unhappy, and that had implications for their academic functioning. If you have mental health problems, no matter how happy you are, in terms of academic outcomes, you're going to be diminished compared to kids that do not have mental health problems. So when we're looking at academic outcomes, it is that combination of high happiness and low mental health problems that co-occurs with the best academic success. And it's not good enough to just not have mental health problems. The presence of happiness has to be there if we want to see the best scores and grades. What about classroom engagement? So this is a sample of elementary school students, and we found that the kids who had the highest level of engagement, both behaviorally and emotionally, were the kids who had complete mental health. And at the younger years, where maybe having mental health problems hadn't yet had the same long-term implications for challenges in the classroom, those kids who at least were happy did have higher levels of engagement than their peers who were troubled. When we look at attitudes about school, we see the best levels of academic confidence and of valuing school co-occur with kids that have that combination of high happiness and low mental health problems. What about attendance? This is how many days the kids missed this year. So lower levels are better attendance, higher levels are more absences. What we see in the middle school samples is that students who are missing the fewest days are the students that have a complete mental health profile. They have high happiness and low mental health problems. Our vulnerable kids, who we would miss on screeners again of mental health problems, had just as many absences as kids who had elevated internalizing exercising problems. So also benefits of attendance for kids who have high happiness in combination with no mental health problems. We also see some implications for social functioning. The students that have the highest levels of classmate support have that complete mental health profile. And when we turn to social functioning, you start seeing some advantages of happiness amongst kids that have mental health problems. That purple group are the symptomatic but content kids, and they report higher levels of support from their classmates and their teachers than their peers who also have elevated symptoms but low happiness. Parent relations and classmate relations, again, highest amongst that profile that has a combination of high happiness and low mental health problems. At the high school level, we looked at additional indicators of social functioning with regard to being satisfied with your dating life and with also how often kids were victimized at school. And we saw the kids who were bullied the most tended to have that profile of high mental health problems and low happiness, whereas students that had the most satisfaction in their romantic relationships had high well-being and low mental health problems. Final set I'll show you are just one more illustration of how happiness matters, and this illustration is in particular with health. Kids who had the fewest health problems, so were getting sick the least often, were the students that had that combination of high happiness and low mental health problems. The students who in turn were missing out the most because of physical health challenges were the troubled students, the students that had high mental health problems and low happiness. So I can show you lots of slides like that, but the ones I showed you hopefully illustrated that there are real benefits of having high happiness along with low mental health problems. So when you look at those two groups of kids who wouldn't come up on screeners of mental health problems, we see differences based on if they have high happiness or not. So the students that have that combination of high happiness and low mental health problems in comparison to their peers that have low mental health problems but also are dissatisfied, you see advantages in physical health, you see advantages in social adjustment, you see advantages of the high school years and their self-concept and their identity development, and you see better academic outcomes. At the elementary school level, you see academic outcomes, academic advantages of engagement. And then at the middle and high school level, we see clear advantages in terms of their grades and their academic skills. So that series of studies has been replicated across many states in our country and across nations recently. And it's a line of work referred to as the dual factor model of mental health. And the outcomes of that research have led a lot of psychologists to reconceptualize what is youth mental health, and reconceptualizing it in particular in a way that defines complete mental health as both as few as symptoms as possible of mental illness, but also the presence of well-being, because simply not having mental illness doesn't mean automatically you have well-being. Instead, if you don't have mental illness, you could be vulnerable or you could have complete mental health. So complete mental health, that profile is indicated by low levels of anxiety, depression, and conduct problems, and high levels of life satisfaction and happiness and strong social relationships. If you have questions about that, type them in and I'll look. that I'm going to move on from that rationale for why happiness matters. And just in sum, it's because it's not the same as mental health, mental illness, and that combination of low mental illness and high well-being is associated with the best outcomes in youth. So this picture is something that drove the definition of complete mental health that I was very proud to be affiliated with through the Florida Aware Project. So this is a flyer that Florida Aware advanced in one of the early years of our 5-year grant. And there's a link here to where the flyer is located so that if you want to share this with other folks at your school or in your district, then you can give them this one pager that defines mental health in a very modern way that takes advantage of what we know from research of how to define youth mental health in ways that matter. So going back one, on the bottom row, right above risk and resilience factors, are really the keys to what do we do about it. So if we agree that mental health is defined as few symptoms of mental illness and the presence of wellness, well then how do we promote those things? Well, in school services, what we do is this address this bottom row, which are the risk factors of problems and the resilience factors that promote well-being. So on the risk factor side, I'm not going to talk a lot about today, anything that you're doing in your schools that addresses those risk factors that lead to mental illness. So on the internalizing form, things that we do to reduce the effects of trauma, prevent trauma, but also have trauma-informed care, and promote positive thinking in kids so that they don't have as many thinking errors and withdrawal in times of stress. So things that teach kids how to cope well and deal with trauma address those risk factors for internalizing challenges. Also, the things that we do in our school to promote consistency across roles and expectations in safe settings are our strategies for decreasing conduct problems. So addressing those risk factors is key. What I'm going to talk about next, though, are the additional school practices that address the resilience factors that underlie life satisfaction and strong social relationships. And in particular, I'm going to focus on in this presentation some universal and early intervention practices that promote positive well-being. So we'll talk about things that stem from social-emotional learning and then also positive psychology interventions and ways of promoting school climate in a way that promotes positive well-being through strengthening relationships. So one just definition I want to throw out there is this concept of resilience. So I mentioned earlier that elementary school kids, their average level of happiness is pretty high. So you're wondering, do I need to do anything then? If kids come to the table already quite happy, why? Why even work on promoting their well-being? Well, I did share also data that over time, kids tend to decrease in happiness, but not all of them do. So what positive psychology aims to do is give all kids the social and emotional skills to increase their positive emotions so that during those vulnerable times, they have skills for making it through in a way that preserves their wellness. So how do we enhance resiliency skills? It's really a two-prong effort. On the far left are skills we can teach kids to take responsibility for themselves. But on the far right, it's all about us as educators and mental health professionals creating settings that allow kids to strive. So on the left, in terms of what we can instill in children, there are definitely internal aspects that come from direct instruction on how to identify and downregulate negative emotions. But what you're going to hear about today are skills for how to identify and upregulate or increase positive emotions. Because simply managing anger doesn't make you feel joyful, right? So you need both those things together. And a lot of social and emotional learning programs are great at teaching kids how to identify and manage negative emotions, but only the more modern ones also infuse some positive psychology construct content to also purposely evoke positive feelings. So what we'll talk about this morning are some strategies that are developed to increase positive emotions in particular. And then on the far right, I'm not going to get too much into this today. I'm going to focus really instead on those strategies to increase positive feelings, but practices and programs that you're already doing that support teachers' mental health, that strengthen classroom relationships, that build family partnerships, and that allow students to learn by being in a safe setting where kids can uptake content, are all in line with ways that we can increase personal resiliency skills. So resilience, again, are those assets and protective factors that allow all children to thrive and allow kids to be resilient during those like natural developmental periods where we see mental health deteriorate if not intervened upon or given students skills in advance. I sometimes feel guilty when I talk to school administrators. They have so many things on their plate and they're like, what? We just got PBIS in place and we're starting screening and I have an SEL program and now you're telling me it's not good enough and you want me to do positive psychology instead? Like, geez. And I feel for schools. It's a tall order to address students' comprehensive mental health. I also know that my own children that are in elementary school don't just learn science. Like they learn science and math and reading and they have lots of subjects. So it's not, if we're not going to expect, really good instruction in math to also get kids all of the way in their science and writing goals, it makes sense too, like why we don't expect instruction in down-regulating negative emotions to also up-regulate positive emotions. So what I like to share with school leaders is my recommendations for solid core practices that if we're trying to address students' complete mental health by reducing, externalizing, and internalizing problems, but also increasing positive emotions, then what is absolutely foundational are these programs and practices in the bottom portion of this triangle. So positive behavior supports are instrumental in reducing kids' externalizing problems. Social-emotional learning and positive psychology are vital for increasing emotion management. And then teacher wellness and classroom relationships are vital in strengthening the climate in our classes. And we want to make sure screening is in place so we know who needs extra help. And some of these slides come right from some of the materials that we developed through Florida Aware. So I want to make sure I acknowledge that also. Not to be overlooked at all is the fact that if we had a perfect environmental circumstance where all kids came from healthy communities, healthy families, our work would be less hard in school. So whatever we could do at the systems level to promote healthy communities and families, that's great. But if what we're just dealing with are the kids that come to the table, those programs and practices in the blue bottom of the triangle are really foundational. And then what schools need to do is layer in additional supports that address your school-specific challenges. But every school is best by starting those initiatives in the blue area. So why is that? I'm going to share with you some data for why some of these things matter. So social-emotional learning, I've dropped that term in earlier. It is something that's increasingly familiar to folks. I won't spend too much time here. But social-emotional learning programs are those that teach kids how to identify and then manage their emotions. And most of the programs pretty much deal exclusively with negative emotions, which is fine, it's important. But it teaches kids how to be self-aware and manage their emotions. Also builds the relational capacities by teaching kids to be aware of emotions in others and to have the skills to navigate when problems show up in social relationships. And then social-emotional learning programs also teach kids a way of making decisions in a planful manner. So how to apply a problem-solving process when things go awry. So when you're faced with a risky situation, how to evaluate what's the best way to proceed. Those are the five core competencies in SEL programs. And SEL programs are increasingly in place in schools throughout our state, which makes my heart very warm. Because what we know from SEL programs is they work as intended, not just promote students' social-emotional skills, but also promote students' academic outcomes. I just pulled examples from one. This is some outcome research from RULER, which is a really neat SEL program that teaches kids to recognize, understand, label, express, and regulate emotions. And the research that has been done on RULER shows that when it's implemented through elementary school classrooms and kids are followed for a few years, in classrooms that are randomly assigned to this curriculum that teachers implement that focuses on emotion management, what is observed in those classrooms a year later is a stronger relationship. There's more emotional support coming from those teachers that are grounded in social-emotional learning. And you look at the kids 2 years later, that social-emotional support stays, but also so do improvements in academic instruction and organization. And then ultimately, students' outcomes are better test grades and fewer learning problems. So this kind of research shows that social-emotional learning works by fostering this positive classroom climate. And that's not just by giving kids skills, but improving the climate, which in turn facilitates learning. So SEL skills are foundational, not just to mental health, but because that mental health predicts academic outcomes. A study that just came out followed a whole bunch of elementary school children who were exposed to SEL content. And what that found was that the level of student social-emotional competence in the middle year, so third grade, went on to predict who was most connected to school and who had the fewest levels of emotional and behavior problems, which in turn predicted which kids had the best academic, math, and reading scores. So when we think about our ultimate goal of schools, of increasing kids' academic skills, it starts pretty early with teaching them how to directly manage their emotions, form positive relationships, which helps them connect and not deteriorate and hang in there and grow academically. So we know SEL matters. We also know that PBIS matters, that schools that implement PBIS with fidelity see not just the improvements in students' social behavior and the school climate, which is what PBIS first started off as doing, but they also see improvements down the road in which schools see the biggest academic gains, so gains in reading and math. So we also know that school-wide PBIS matters. It works to make kids feel safer in school, regulate their behaviors, and get access to instruction. So what about happiness? What do we know about happiness? Well, happiness is newer on the scene. We've only had measures of it since like the mid to late 90s. We've only had interventions of it in the last, my daughter is 10, and I did the first intervention when I was pregnant with her, so I guess it's been 10 and a half years that we first did the first application of a positive psychology intervention that worked with adults and tried it in schools and saw that it worked. And only in the last 5 or 6 years have folks done school-wide applications and looked at really good outcome data to see does it matter. So what I'm going to share with you is some hot off the press outcome data. Most of it is from overseas, where a focus on well-being has taken off a little more quickly than over here in America, although we're catching on. So what some research has shown is that in schools that are randomly assigned to a focus on subjective well-being and put programs and practices in place that purposely seek to upregulate positive emotions, build relationships, and then address some of the building blocks of happiness, which you'll learn in the coming minutes, have to do with gratitude, hope, optimism, identifying and using your character strengths, that when schools put in place a way of teaching teachers why this matters and giving them strategies to go out and do it in their classrooms and with themselves, that the schools that are randomly assigned to a positive psychology approach education see, as intended, increases in kids' happiness, but also over the course of 2 years, see improvements in students' academic outcomes. This has been really exciting data to see come out of universal applications of positive psychology programs. And I could update this slide just last year. This is middle school data, middle schools that were randomly assigned to a positive education approach that had these emphasis, or business as usual, saw gains in kids' mental health and also academics. But just last year, a study came out that looked at these same types of targets in kindergarten classrooms. and schools or random classrooms of kindergarten students are randomly assigned to well-being, they also saw the same improvements in students' engagement and readiness to learn compared to business as usual. So just in the recent years, we have good outcome data that this theory works as intended. So where does that leave us? That leaves us with really needing to emphasize three different types of initiatives, if you will, in schools. Social-emotional learning programs and school-wide PBIS, even though I'm not going to talk about them any further, I'm going to highlight that what I know best, which is the positive psych programs. Those two things are foundational because they address different targets. Remember, going back to our definition of comprehensive mental health is that combination of low mental illness and high happiness. SEL programs do a really good job of addressing internalizing symptoms. They reduce how many kids have anxiety, depression, and they reduce behavior problems. School-wide PBIS does a really good job of reducing the externalizing component of mental illness. What positive psychology interventions do in particular is increase positive emotions. They address that wellness side. And all three of these, fortunately, hit on strengthening relationships, which is key to both of those areas. So I'm going to turn to positive psychology interventions in particular. And if you have questions, again, I'm able to multitask and can read on that left-hand side. So what are positive psychology interventions? They are interventions that stem directly from the field of psychology referred to as positive psychology. This term was advanced in the year 2000 by Martin Seligman, who was the president of APA, and he organized folks that were already studying indicators of wellness and strategies for promoting wellness. And he said, you know, you guys all have in common this way of work of looking at mental health functioning beyond disease. Let's pull our collective knowledge and together form a group of folks that are intended to assess wellness beyond problems and strive for flourishing and accomplishment. So what positive psychology brought to the table was a focus on aiming for building the best things in life, the skills for optimum experiences, as opposed to repairing what's broken. So the attention to positive in this approach deals with positive feelings, positive character, and positive institutions, so settings that allow folks to flourish. Again, I mentioned this is relatively new, so those measures of youth happiness came on the scene in the 90s. That term, positive psychology, came about in the year 2000. In the early 2000s, when I was a graduate student, we were doing a lot of studies to figure out what are the things that co-occur with happiness. What matters? What we saw were the correlates of happiness were things like social functioning, optimism, gratitude, hope. And it mattered because kids that had higher happiness were the students that were doing the best in different areas. And when they incurred stressors, students that had high life satisfaction were more likely to be resilient in times of stress. There were functions of happiness. So based on that rationale for happiness mattering, and knowing the things that it co-occurred with, the first interventions to improve youth happiness started being developed and tested in, again, 2008. So it hasn't been that long that we've started developing, tweaking, refining, and improving interventions to improve youth happiness. And then after folks have seen it works with small groups of kids, they've made it into a larger universal application only in our current decade. So what are those strategies that people have been developing for the last 10 or so years? Well, it comes from Martin Seligman's theory of authentic happiness. And his original theory is the way of feeling really, really good has to do with having positive emotions about your past, your present, and your future. So I'm going to share with you some activities that were developed by positive psychologists to do just that, to invoke positive feelings of your past, your present, and your future. And some of the activities are things like gratitude journals and gratitude visits. Things that evoke positive feelings about the present are performing acts of kindness and identifying and using your character strengths. And then when you have a positive feeling, really savoring it. And then positive feelings of the future come from activities like best possible self in the future, and then strategies of developing optimistic thoughts. So those are the skills that kids learn and adults learn in a positive psych approach. But again, what undergirds all of this are healthy relationships. So positive psychology strategies in schools do two things. They build students' assets and internal ability to upregulate positive emotions, but they also strengthen relationships. So you have a resource list in your file pod that's a Word document, about 2 pages that I put together, just getting mine out. Sorry for the papers rustling. And in your resource list, because we're not going to cover all this today, there are some websites and books and articles for future self-study, if you will. Also some good websites to refer parents to. So under the books and articles, there is a great article that Shankland and Rosett put out 2 years ago that was a review of all this, of all these activities are on the screen plus more. It's an article that was developed for teachers. So if you work with teachers in particular, it's a relatively lengthy read, but it's a nice summary of positive ecology interventions that teachers can do in their classroom. Patricia O'Grady wrote a book for elementary school teachers in particular, and the book that I have out called Promoting Student Happiness is geared towards school psychologists, school counselors, school social workers who want to know how to integrate this into their daily mental health services. Those are some books I recommend. And then there's some great websites, too, that I'm going to highlight throughout the talk. So they're on your resource list. So let's start. I'll first walk you through those activities. So our theory for why these interventions to increase kids' happiness have these like downstream effects on academics come from Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build theory. And what Barbara Fredrickson, who's a social psychologist, found years ago was that positive emotions serve functions. Like, yeah, they feel good in the moment. So if one of my grad students was to come by right now and give me a piece of chocolate, I would really feel good right now because I'm eating chocolate. But what we don't always think about is eating chocolate right now actually makes me more likely to feel good later, because as I'm eating my chocolate, my creativity gets a little bit better. I'm able to problem solve more. I think better. I would be in a better mood. Something stressful happened to me, I'd be able to manage it. And then because I'm managing it so well, people want to be around me. So all of a sudden, I have these improved social relationships and more resources. And by building these social and cognitive resources, you're able to approach things that maybe you wouldn't otherwise approach, have more opportunity to learn, and use your resources to succeed, which allows you to do better in the classroom. So that's the theory called broaden and build, that positive emotions start this upward chain that propels you towards wellness. That's a theory that she advanced, and she has shown this theory to work in hundreds of studies. So that theory of emotion-serving functions has been around for a long, long time, and is behind what is the current thinking for what makes a flourishing mental health state. That somebody who is optimally doing optimal wellness, flourishing, is feeling good in the moment, but they're also doing good because of these positive feelings that help propel them to wellness. And the indicators of flourishing are on the bottom of your screen. That subjective well-being thing I mentioned earlier is still really, really paramount in the current model of flourishing, but we also know it's not enough to just feel good in the moment. Other ways of achieving flourishing are engaging in your work, feeling a sense of accomplishment, pursuing purpose and having a meaning, and then having this positive relationship. And what undergirds all of those pillars of flourishing are character strengths. So what's a character strength? One of the very first missions of positive ecology was to better operationalize good mental health. I think it was about 2002 was the year that I was at one of the very first conferences met to organize folks in this new area of positive psychology, and it was hosted by Gallup in DC. And Martin Seligman and Chris Peterson said one of the first things we've got to do as a group is make an un-DSM. So the DSM is our Bible of defining every single thing wrong with mental health. And positive psychology folks wanted to make another compendium of everything that could be right. So they set out to look to see what were the character strengths that are present across cultures and across societies. And they started with a really, really big list. And over a number of years, through a lot of studies, whittled it down to this list I have on the screen of 24 strengths of character that fall within six virtues, if you will. And there's all kinds of ways of defining those. Well, there's actually only one definition per character strength, but there's different ways of explaining them to you. So this is one of the ways that we've been showing this list of character strengths to middle and high school students. But it comes from Park and Peterson's work. There's other ways. If you go to viacharacter.org, great website. I have it listed on your list of handouts. And they have lists of really nice posters of icons that go from defining each of these strengths in one word to using pictures for children to all kinds of words like I have on the screen here. So you'll see, and then actually in your file pod, if you scroll down to classification of 24 character strengths, VIA Institute, that's the one that I give to adults most often, and it defines each of the 24 character strengths. So those character strengths are things that we all have within us, but to varying degrees. And what positive psychology tries to do is to get folks to recognize what are the strengths that come most easily to us, and that's our signature strengths, if you will. And it's a little bit easier, I feel, to identify strengths in others than yourself. So one of the activities I'd like to do first with adults and youth that are learning about character strengths is to do a strength spotting activity. So after you become familiar with the definitions of those 24 character strengths, one of the things that we ask kids to do and teachers to do is we give them a post-it note and we tell them to pick somebody they know reasonably well, like at their table or in their class, and identify, write down one character strength that you feel the person that you have in mind shows. That's the first step in strength spotting, is to use your vocabulary and label a strength of character that someone demonstrates. The next step in strength spotting is to explain it. So we have them on a post-it note in the situation, write down a time when the person showed that strength. And then the third and final step in strength spotting is to appreciate it. So why do you benefit from that person's strength? So a quick little activity you could do with kids in your class or your colleagues or students you work with in a small group is on that post-it note I've got on the right-hand corner. But there's lots of ways of strength spotting. You don't have to use a tangible like a post-it note. You could simply, like my daughter, for instance, I've said to her before, you know, Emma, I really appreciate how you appreciate, she appreciates beauty and excellence, one of her best signature strengths. It's our ability to appreciate beauty and excellence. And I say, when you take the time to point out that daddy mowed the lawn and it looks great, it really makes him feel so wonderful that you've recognized it. It goes right over my head that he mowed the lawn, but you always notice when things look nice, and I appreciate that. In the same way, you know, she's a gifted pianist, and I love that she wants to get better at piano. To me, what she played when she was 5 sounded just as good as what she plays now at age 10. But to her, it all sounds different. So her character strength of appreciating beauty and excellence is showed through her ability to do well in piano and strive in piano. Also in how she appreciates the hard work her husband does in the garden. And that matters because it makes him feel recognized and it gives us beautiful music to listen to in the evening. That's an example of strength spotting. You can do it verbally or through a post-it note, but lots of ways to strength spot. So after folks have comfort with strength spotting in others, then we allow them to get into what are their own character strengths. One way of doing that is by listening to the strengths that others spot in you. And you start to see, okay, maybe that is one of my signature strengths. But a more objective way, if you will, is to hop online and to complete surveys of character strengths. So if you go to character.org, it's called Brief because remember, there's 24 strengths. There's 4 items per strength, so it takes a lot of items to get all the strengths. But it used to be worse. It used to be 198-item questionnaire that fortunately is now whittled down to 96 items on the youth survey. And students complete a Likert measure that at the end tells them what their top character strengths are. For adults, if you're curious what your top character strengths are, you could either go to authentichappiness.org, which is Martin Seligman's website he started about 20 years ago, or you can go to VIA Character. These are all free measures when I have my children and my students take them, we use the viacharacter.org, and an adult needs a login, but not a child. So as a practitioner, you would create a login, and then you can make lots of kids profiles underneath your login. So when you take the measure, which is, again, for adults, about 240 items, for kids, about 96, it'll give you a screenshot of your top strengths. So this is my profile when I took the Authentic Happiness measure. I took the VIA survey on Authentic Happiness website. It tells you your top strengths. These are ipsative. So what were the areas where my mean score was the highest? Okay. So what's nice about that is everyone has top strengths. Even children that are really struggling are going to have areas that are higher than their other areas. These are your top five scores. It's ipsative. It's not normative. So my top five strengths were in the areas of hope, grit, gratitude, love, and perspective. That's a pretty common profile for a psychologist. What you don't want to do, though, and this is what a lot of high-achieving folks do, is scroll to the bottom and see what are the things you're worst off at. And that's kind of what traditional character education did, was say, you should be good in all of these. Let's teach these one at a time. Instead, what Positive Psych does is help you identify your signature strengths so that you can, in turn, know what to apply in settings. So it helps you identify your strengths, and you then go forth and conquer with those. So it's about nurturing your top strengths. Danielle knows her top strengths too. All right, so this is the child version. So the child version, if you go through the VIA character website, this is what they see. This is a sample printout from a student I worked with. It looks pretty similar to the adult version, but a little more user-friendly. So what do you do with this knowledge? Well, identifying your signature strength is the very first step. I guess the very first step is knowing the vocabulary, right? So knowing that list of 24 and then what they mean, and then start applying them. And after you start applying them, after you start knowing the terms and seeing them, then you want to make a plan for arranging your daily life in a way that you really use those strengths. Nancy asked what's the website you can access this at? It is right here. So the viacharacter.org is where the kid one came from, and authentichappiness.org is the adult version. The measure is called the VIA survey. I'm going to type that in. A long time ago, it stood for Values and Action Inventory, but for some reason they dropped the actual acronym, they dropped the terms, not just the VIA survey, but it was Values and Action Inventory of Strengths. And it's at authentichappiness.org or viacharacter.org, and both of them are free measures. No problem. Okay, so once you identify your strengths, then what we do with kids is help them make a plan for using those strengths in new ways. So this is a child whose strengths were was curiosity. So we had her in this week make a plan for how she was going to use that strength, and then track her feelings after she used the strength, so that she could become an emotion detective and see, wow, when I take what comes naturally to me, one of my gifts of character, and apply it on purpose, I'm taking control of my own positive feelings. And then after kids get the hang of that, then we ask them to pick another of their top five strengths. And top five, usually the kind of cut point for your signature strength. So a different student next chose teamwork. And we say, okay, so you mastered the art of using curiosity. Let's try applying teamwork in new and unique ways across your life. And don't just do it at school, do it with your friends and at home. And after you use these strengths in new ways, track not just how you feel, but how can you savor that positive feeling? So this is just a worksheet we use with kids to help them organize how to use their strengths in new ways. Littler kids sometimes struggle with this type of like action planning, right? So when we've been working with elementary school kids the last 2 years, we've had to get more creative. And what we've been doing with kids that really has been popular with them is called a strength superhero. So they take one of your top five strengths and then make a superhero out of that strength. So this is the child whose strength is creativity. So his superhero was going to be creativity boy, time to draw. And then the next thing is, okay, take your strength and plan how the superhero is going to use it. So he was going to use his strength by helping people draw And then he was going to turn his pictures into charities. That was very sweet. I'm not sure where they ended up going. But that was his plan for using his strengths. And in your file pod, I just uploaded the worksheet we created to do that. It says superhero on it. This is a gratitude journal. So I'm going to move from strengths now. So character strengths is a way of, as a positive activity for increasing your positive feelings in the present. Okay? So what are some other activities beyond character strengths? We're going to talk now about gratitude and hope. So this is a gratitude journal. Keeping a gratitude journal is an evidence-based way to increase positive emotions. So what we ask kids to do is to journal about five things they're grateful for right now. And we have kids do this daily. So this is an elementary school child. He was thankful that my mom's able to see me every day. Thankful for his dad because he's calm and fun. Thankful for his sister when she talks to me. He was thankful for my dog when he cuddles. And the last thing the child wrote is, I'm thankful for my fish and hermit crab because they're easy and meditative. So that was what he was thankful for right then. And why this works to increase happiness is because it evokes positive feelings about the past. This child can be thinking about all kinds of things right now, but we have purposely directed his attention to positive features of his past. Another way of doing that is by asking kids to perform a gratitude visit. So we ask them to brainstorm about five people who have been kind to them, but they haven't yet properly thanked, or fully thanked. So this child generated a list, mom, sister, brother, his math teacher, his coach. And said, okay, of your list of people that have been really kind to you, who can you feasibly see in the next week? And he chose his mom. I said, great. So pick a date and time where you're going to share with her a letter that we'll write together about why you're grateful for her. So this is another elementary school example where the child wrote out, dear mom, thank you for always being there for me and taking me places I want to go. Thank you for feeding me and for keeping me under a roof and getting me the things that I need and loving me. Hugs and kisses, love your nice son. So think about this child who's writing this letter, directing his attention and noticing all the kind things his mom does for him on a daily basis. Then he reads this letter aloud to mom. How do you think mom feels? Mom probably is like overcome with the fact he notices all these things. This is a fourth grader. Like, wow, my son noticed him keeping a roof over his head. So she's likely to be a little even more kind back to him. And then the kid feels even better. So gratitude visits are one of these things that evoke positive feelings, but also strengthen relationships. Another activity is the same double whammy of evoking positive feelings in the moment, but also strengthening relationships are acts of kindness. So we ask kids to do five acts of kindness in a given day. So it's different than gratitude journaling. Gratitude journaling, we ask kids to do it every day. What scientists have found out in studies of acts of kindness, if you spread that out over the week, you tend to acclimate to it. But when you have like one designated day where you do multiple acts of kindness, you see an increase at last in your happiness. So we ask kids to pick one day that they're going to do their acts of kindness, and then we ask them to make a plan and then go forth and conquer and then come back and talk to us about it. So this is, a middle schooler, and her acts of kindness were going to be making dinner for her family, thanking her eye doctor for her new glasses, and then helping mom buy the groceries, putting them away, and gardening with her mother. And that was going to be her Saturday plan. Two more activities I'm going to share with you before I turn to how do you put this all together in some systematic manner. Two more activities that have an evidence base for increasing kids' positive emotions are writing activities that purposely help them think about their past or their futures. So in the past, this is an activity called Me at My Best or You at Your Best. And we ask kids, I say, think of a time when you were at your best, that you were using your strengths and that things went well, and write about that time. And in your file pod, you actually have this prompt. And I love doing it with teachers in particular. This is right from the VIA website. It says, you at your best, VIA Institute of Character, and it's the writing prompt to get folks to think of the time they were at their best. So this is a middle school girl's example. We have them write, and then they share out. So when she was writing, she wrote about, well, every day when I get home and eat dinner, I play the piano and cello, and I try to do my best to make beautiful music for my parents and for myself. It takes a lot of hard work and concentration, but for me, it's gotten easier since I play almost every day. I try to outdo myself and do better than what I did yesterday and achieve my goals. This is me at my best every day. So how this activity works is she's, again, purposely training her attention to a time in the past that went well, and then she's savoring that experience. Then when we ask her to share it with a table partner or with me as a school psychologist or share it with a teacher, then she's reliving that positive feeling. And then what you do next usually is ask for folks to strength spot. So in the comment box and chat, what are some of the character strengths that you see in this young lady's story? Talk about strength spotting. What's at least one character strength that you identify that you could see based on her story? The ones that we often hear are things like persistence, appreciation of beauty and excellence, love, because she's trying things, zest, yeah, lots of zest. That's a great one. And Danielle is using the terminology right from the VIA, which is wonderful. So we try to apply that VIA terminology side by side to allow folks an opportunity to strength spot and to get really familiar with the character strength terminology. We have so many words for identifying what's wrong with folks, but not always describing what's right. Perseverance, right from the VIA. She is persisting and making the best possible music. Great. So this is an example of an activity that purposely trains you to think good about the past, say your positive feelings, and then strength spot. On the next slide, what I have is an example of visualization again, but rather than the past, this is a hope-generating activity. So it's another writing activity, and this I'm going to show you an elementary school modification. But rather than saying when's the best you were at in the past, let's think instead about your best possible self in the future. So we ask our individuals, either the youth or the adults we work with, to think of the best possible self in the future. So the directions are think about your life in the future. Everything has gone as well as it could. You've worked hard and succeeding in accomplishing all of your goals. Draw a picture or write about what you've imagined in the space below. So this is a fourth grader, and her best possible self in the future was getting honor roll. So that's her picture, is her straight A's hanging up on her refrigerator at home. So in hope theory, having a clear goal is the very first step. The next step is thinking about the pathways that you will take to achieve that goal. So her pathways were to, she was going to achieve that all A's by concentrating, trying her best, not being absent, not being late, and getting no behavior marks, which sounds to me like a pretty good recipe for fourth grade honor roll. So those are just some examples, guys, of positive activities that have come from this positive psychology framework that folks have applied and seen lasting gains in happiness as a function of these individual activities, things like best possible self in the future, me at my best in the past, acts of kindness, gratitude visits, gratitude journals, using your character strengths. What we're going to talk about now, and I know some folks will leave at 11:30, but we got started a little bit late. This will be archived. You can come back and watch the rest later. We'll talk about our ways of putting this together in Tier 2 and Tier 1 programming that build on those character strengths. So the Tier 2 programming is described in a book I was asked to write for Guilford a few years ago called Promoting Student Happiness. And it's a book developed for school psychologists, school counselors, school social workers. And what it does is provide the manual for a 10-session well-being promotion program that we do in small groups for kids that have room for growth and happiness. So again, Tier 2, kids who have room for growth and happiness. And how we determine who that is we do a screening for life satisfaction. And the screening measure we use is the Brief Multidimensional Student Life Satisfaction Scale for Children. And we screen all students' life satisfaction with this measure. This is a 1-7 measure of happiness. It's for free in the public domain. It's also included in the back of my book, or I screenshot it in case you just wanted to use it. And the file pod is a version we've used with little kids in the past few years. But this is a measure that we use statewide in South Carolina for grades 3 through 12. So lots of evidence for reliability and readability. So kids on a scale of 1 to 7 say how happy they are with their family, their friendships, their school, their selves, and where they live, and life on the whole at that global aspect. And we usually offer the well-being promotion program for any kid who is under-pleased. That's quite the cut point, right? So if you're delighted, maybe you don't need this stuff right now. But if you're pleased, you have room for growth. And if you're under-pleased, that runs from my happiness is terrible all the way to mostly satisfied, then we invite them to take part in the well-being promotion program. So you can make your cut score wherever you want at your school. I'm fortunate to have lots of undergraduates doing this work with me, graduate students, so we can serve a lot of kids. If I had fewer kids to serve, I'd probably make a lower cut point. But when we invite all kids, we take anybody whose mean score is less than 6. So what those students do is within a small group and led by a school counselor or school psychologist or a trainee is go through a series of sessions where they do the same activities you guys just saw. So for instance, in session 1, we start with psychoeducation on what is happiness and why it matters. And then we jump into gratitude journals. The next week, gratitude visits. The next week, we go to acts of kindness. Then what are character strengths? Let's use the first one in a new way, next one in a new way. I cut out autistic thoughts at a time, but we teach them a way of thinking that's based in learned optimism. Then we end off on you at your best, and then we review. And this program, when it works the best, also has a parent component. And in the parent component, we ask parents to come in just one time at the very beginning to learn about why happiness matters and what their kids are going to learn. It also gives us a time to explain why their child was selected for this Tier 2 program. And the goal of the parent meeting, again, is to explain why their kid was invited to attend, what will they learn in the small group, and then give them a chance to actually experience it themselves. So in that first session, we do either me at my best or a favoring activity. And then each week after, parents receive a handout that covers what the child learned in the small group. So here's an example handout from gratitude journaling. And all of these resources are included in the back of the book I showed you earlier, Promoting Student Happiness. So it's pretty low-tech resources, but we email them out or send them home in hard copy. So that's the program. I'm not going through the sessions a lot because I showed these activities earlier. But the program, again, it's a small group for kids that have room for growth and happiness. So does it work? We've done a series of randomized controlled trials, and one that was published in School Psychology Review about a year and a half ago established that from these scores, the dark line are kids who are in the well-being promotion program. The dashed line are their classmates who are randomly assigned to a waitlist condition where they took part the very next semester. So the kids all started the same on the life satisfaction scale. 10 weeks later, which is the length of the program, the kids, they're middle school students, the kids that were in the program experienced significant increases in life satisfaction that at 2 follow-up points up to 2 months later were still significantly higher than their peers who were in the control condition. The students who went through the well-being promotion program also increased significantly in positive emotions, and those gains stayed, and they reduced in negative affect, and that improvement stayed significant too over the course of a few months. The students who went through the well-being promotion program also incurred decreases in internalizing problems and decreases in externalizing problems. At the same time, we saw some movement in the wrong direction for kids who were waiting for the program. So we have some evidence that that program, where you purposely teach kids skills for increasing positive emotions, is related to lasting gains in happiness. So that's some work I've been doing for about 10 years now. About 5 years ago, maybe 6 now, I was asked, does this stuff work for elementary school kids? Because most of our research has been with middle and high school students. So in the last 5 years, I've been working with schools throughout this area to make a version of this intervention that's for the entire class of students. First, we worked with 3rd through 5th grade students, and then in recent years, made it more developmentally appropriate for kindergarten, 1st and 2nd, and I'll share what that looks like now. So when we work with teachers, one thing we do is say, you know, you don't need a full program. If you just know conceptually what are the practices that increase positive feelings, then you can feel free to integrate those into your daily lessons and teach kids things like gratitude, keeping a gratitude journal, doing acts of kindness. And then when you have a choice in a writing prompt, do things like you at your best or best possible self in the future. So that's one way to go with elementary school teachers and classes, is just educating teachers on what are the activities that promote kids' well-being. Another way of work is to implement in like a lesson-by-lesson fashion the same strategies that we're doing with small groups of kids for quite some time now. What we have done with elementary school classrooms, though, is if you have the entire class, you have so much more room for improving classroom relationships, which is great. So a modification that we've done when we've applied the well-being promotion program to classes is to start by, at the beginning of each session, asking the classmates, asking the students, hey, in the last week, what are some acts of care and support you have seen your friends do and your teacher? So we give them a time to brag on each other and point out when they have seen kind acts for their teacher or their classmate. And that does two things. One is it helps their classmates or teacher feel in the moment, but it also helps the teacher see what it is in the eyes of a child that actually matters and conveys care. To measure life satisfaction in little kids, we've had to modify that BMISL scale. So this is a version that we've been developing for about 3 years now. This one finally works really well. We had to simplify it more and more. So this is a measure. So this is the same brief multidimensional student life satisfaction scale as we did earlier. And rather than having all of those words, it breaks it down to pictures. So how happy are you with each area of life, but as depicted by a picture? And then rather than answering with numbers, kids respond with smiley faces. And we've had nice support for reliability in using this for K-5 children. And that's also in your file pod. So with younger kids, so this kind of lesson-by-lesson approach has worked with third through fifth. But what we've seen with younger kids is that having a mostly didactic lesson and then one activity has not flown over so well. So some ideas for littler kids. We've used a lot of songs and books. So I'm sharing with you on these slides some ones that we really liked. So when we work with smaller children, you're teaching them about the VIA character strengths. Kindergartners, I can tell you from experience just last year, don't tolerate 24 strengths. That's too much vocabulary, too many strengths. So we have reduced it down to a smaller group of character strengths. And introduce the terminology through this book that aligns with the VIA. There's actually a few options out there. It's just the one that I like the best. There's a question about, are there consent forms needed for parents with the surveys? That's a question I'm going to ask you to bring back to your district leaders. Districts really vary in their process. So right now, for instance, I'm working with the elementary school in my area, and we have done a parent notification of the fact that we are screening students for life satisfaction and monitoring it as part of our way of work to make sure we're enhancing all kids' happiness. So parents can opt out of the survey we're going to be using just next week, barring a hurricane. But if we then identify kids who have low happiness and we target them for a small group, absolutely need parent permission for small group services. The nice part, though, about doing work like this with all kids is that if it's a class-wide way of work to increase all students' happiness, that's just your curriculum, and you don't need extra permission for targeted services. So when we work with K through 2 students, what we do is share with them in developmentally appropriate ways what are their strengths and reduce down the number. When we teach them about gratitude, same thing. We have found books that work well, and then we have them use post-its where they give notes of gratitude. There's also the worksheets out there for what they're thankful for. It looks like my wording on the thankfulness web really went awry and converted it to sorry. But we have them with yarn or a beach ball. They could roll each other. They either throw the yarn or roll the beach ball and then say one thing they're grateful for about that student, so one thing they appreciate about that kid. So other activities that are more exciting than just gratitude journals and gratitude visits. For kindness, We really liked the bucket books, if you will. How You Fill the Bucket Today is a great one for K to five. And then for older students, fifth grade and up, we've liked the version on the bottom right of the screen. There's also a really cool video on Sesame Street that introduces kindness that has Tori Kelly in it that my students really liked. So those are just some options for modifying these things for K to two. We've also seen a lot more success with the younger kids of taking away the writing burden. So rather than writing about their best possible self in the past or future, they can do that or they can draw a picture. So this is just some examples of how some students have chosen to write or draw. So does this work? What we've been doing is tracking kids' life satisfaction from before the intervention to after the intervention. The first study we published, we saw growth in kids' life satisfaction in every area as they went through this program. It's a small scale study in this one, but we did this with 200 students at a school last year, actually in the spring of 2019, and saw growth and happiness in every single grade level from K to five. So we have some nice data to show that this intervention, kids become happier as intended. So the final thing I'll talk about is addressing teachers' happiness. I've been kid-focused so far, but these strategies that improve students' happiness come from the literature on what works with adults. We've just been making them more developmental appropriate. So there's no reason that these same strategies can't be things that teachers do themselves. And why we want to do that is because teachers who feel unhappy and burnt out, if you will, have what is referred to as a burnout cascade, that they're more likely to be negative in the classroom if their overall feeling is of exhaustion and cynicism and negativity. So one of the things that we have done with teachers over the last few years, and my graduate student Molly McCullough, now a school psychologist in Polk County Schools, pioneered this, was to develop a series of coaching meetings where the school psychologist as coach first met with a teacher and introduced to him or her the VIA system and had them fill out the VIA survey online to learn their top strengths, then asked the teacher to, okay, pick one of these strengths and use it in your classroom in the next week. And then the next week met back for their coaching session and said, how'd it go? Let's either savor your successes or troubleshoot your barriers, and then pick another strength to use in the coming week. And what Molly saw through her research, the single case design, is that compared to baselines of far left, middle is during the intervention, far right is after she removed herself from the coaching sessions, even though there was some variability in day-to-day happiness, for instance, the top left graph in the middle, the blue, started working with the teacher, and her happiness scores plummeted this final day because she was being observed by her principal that day in the classroom. She was really nervous. So even though there's some variability in daily feelings, the overall average increased from baseline to then using your strengths and then even stayed higher after they stopped doing the intervention. Why? Why on these red lines do we see happiness staying higher after, even with the absence of a coach saying, did you use your strengths? Well, two reasons. One is that broaden and build. Teachers purposely took control over their positive feelings and ran with it. So they experience those positive resources that flow from positive emotions. Second reason that the teachers continued to grow was because they then had the skills of what works. What works is knowing my strengths and using them. So we saw in this study improvements from baseline to after that four session over a course of 2 weeks intervention. We saw after before and after 2 weeks, improvements in work satisfaction, in flourishing, and decreases in stress and burnout that kept going in the positive direction a month later. So to sum up everything I've talked about in the last hour and 20 minutes or so, we first started off with what is mental health and a modern definition. And a modern definition of mental health, again, is reflected in high happiness and as few as possible symptoms of mental health problems. That complete mental health profile definitely tends to be what co-occurs with the best academic, social, physical health, and identity outcomes. And fortunately, we know there are evidence-based ways of improving happiness. We've had for a while a number of evidence-based ways to reduce mental health problems. But only in the last 10 years have we had strategies that work to increase wellness. And those strategies that work to increase wellness purposely evoke positive feelings about the past, present, and future using the strategies you guys have been exposed to in the last hour. I wanted to underscore, though, they should not occur in isolation, that teaching students how to upregulate their positive emotions are best off when they occur in, with a foundation of how to behave well in school, manage your behavior, and down-regulate negative emotions. That combination of social-emotional learning and PBIS and positive psychology strategies is really foundational to making a complete mental health profile in your students. And strengthening relationships does wonders for all three of those areas. So I wanted to end by referring you back to this model of complete mental health that's available at the Student Support Services website. There's also some discussion questions that we're probably not going to have time to get to in terms of how to do these things at your school. Someone asked a question, how do we use measures of life satisfaction? So the kind of final thing I had in here, if we had time, was a discussion of how to use and what are the ways of measuring happiness and how to use these indicators. So the question was, student life satisfaction, multidimensional, is there a difference? So great question. There's two different ways to assess kids' happiness. One is, how do you feel life overall? That's the global one that's assessed by the student life satisfaction scale. Another is to look at those individual areas of life. What we see, though, as in a research community, is those scores correlate about 0.9. So it doesn't matter which one you use, because the areas that are on the multidimensional measures are the domains that predict global happiness. You could use either the global life satisfaction scale or the brief multidimensional. Both are nice screening measures of 6-7 item indices of kids' happiness. There are lengthier measures out there, though, that as a clinician will give you more information on a student's happiness in a particular domain. So the multidimensional student satisfaction measure is a 40 item measure of happiness in those 5 areas assessed really well. The student emotional health scale I really like a lot from this next screen. This is Mike Furlong's work. These are all things that are available for free in the public domain. You've got to figure out a data system for analyzing your, monitoring and analyzing your data, but the items are free. So those are two options for a lengthier measure, the multidimensional and the student's environmental, the SDHS, Student's Emotional Health Survey. The one to use the progress monitoring tool in my own work, I often use the SLSS as a progress monitoring tool and the D-missiles. So it's really up to you, but which of those two makes most sense for you. For affect, there are researchers use a measure called the PANIS very often, but if you look at the resource list, there is a link to the NIH toolbox, and the NIH tool, I'm sorry, I can't remember the toolbox or toolkit, but the NIH toolkit, I believe, which is, again, on your resource list, has a whole bunch of psychometrically sound free measures, including measures of positive and negative affect. So if you'd like to comprehensively supplement your look at life satisfaction with affect, then use that link to the NIH measures. But the life satisfaction measures, are published in my book because Guy Huebner wrote that chapter, and they're free in the public domain, so they're in there too. So I am happy to stick around and answer any questions. If you want to type any into the chat room, I will be here for you. I also can be reached later on at my email, which is soldo@usf.edu. So you can email me with follow-up questions. Otherwise, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew to tell us next steps.